Welcome to the Security Nexus Deep Dive. We invite you to explore more insights into the evolving security landscape over at thesecuritynexus.net. So, who are we? The Security Nexus is a Maryland-based national security consultancy. We focus on strategic advisory, education, public engagement, really digging into things like cyber threats, hybrid warfare, and strategic security policy. Our mission is pretty simple: to inform, educate, and empower. We want to give professionals and the public clear, accessible, actionable knowledge. And today, we are definitely diving deep. We're looking at source material that unpacks, well, a revolution happening on the battlefield. Specifically, the huge impact of small, low-cost drones. We'll be drawing a lot from the conflict in Ukraine. We're relying on insights from analysts and reporters like Katarina Bondar, Warren P. Strobel, David Kirichenko, and also reports from organizations like KDN. Their work is absolutely vital to understanding what's going on. Okay, let's get into it.
Absolutely. And when you look through these sources, there's one event that just screams game changer. It really stands out.
You're talking about Operation Spider's Web, right? Even the name is something else. Katarina Bondar covers this really well in her CSIS analysis. She describes this meticulously planned drone strike June 1st, 2025.
Exactly that. Ukrainian forces launched this thing deep, deep inside Russia. You know, forget fighting just across the border. They hit four strategic air bases: Olenya, Diaghilevo, Belaya, and Ivanovo. And what was so significant, as Bondar really emphasizes, was the sheer depth of the strike. These bases are hundreds, sometimes maybe even 1,000 kilometers from Ukraine.
Wow.
It showed they could reach far, far beyond what anyone thought were the traditional front lines.
And the damage. Bondar's report says over 40 aircraft destroyed. And we're not talking small planes here.
No, no. Vital assets. We're talking strategic 295 bear bombers, crucial A-50 AWACS planes. Those are the flying command posts.
40 strategic aircraft. That's huge.
It's a catastrophic blow, particularly to Russia's long-range aviation. Think about those A-50s. Losing, what, maybe 10% of their airborne command and control capability in one go? That's immense. And for bombers like the 295 and the 222 M3 backfire, Bondar points out replacing those is incredibly hard, almost impossible, really, because of aging supply chains, production limits. They just can't build them quickly anymore.
Okay, so massive operational impact. But this goes deeper, doesn't it? This wasn't just a successful raid. It feels like it proves something bigger about modern war. The sources call it asymmetric value.
Yeah, that's the key concept here. It's this idea that you see discussed across the analyses. Low-end systems achieving high-end effects. In Spider's Web, you had drones costing maybe, what, $600, maybe $1,000? And they were used to disable or destroy aircraft platforms worth hundreds of millions.
That cost difference is just, it's mind-boggling. Warren Strobel's reporting in the Washington Post really drives this home. He quotes General Brian Fenton telling Congress something like, adversaries are using $10,000 one-way drones that we shoot down with $2 million missiles.
Exactly. That kind of mismatch.
Yeah.
It's simply not sustainable long-term.
We've seen other examples too, right? Like the Houthis using maybe a $2,000 drone against a U.S. Navy destroyer, which fires a $2 million defensive missile.
Right.
When you're forced into that kind of spending imbalance, it puts incredible strain on budgets. It forces really tough choices about, well, defense economics.
So how did they pull it off? How did Ukraine get this asymmetric effect in Spider's Web? It wasn't just chucking drones over the border, clearly.
Not at all. Bondar's analysis really gets into the cleverness of it. They didn't launch from miles away. They used consumer-grade FPV drones first-person view, where the operator sees what the drone sees, like they're inside it. But the key was they smuggled them close to the targets first.
Smuggled them.
How? Reportedly, yeah. Bondar details how they use things like disguised cargo trucks to get the drones and operators near the air bases. This let them launch locally, essentially bypassing the big layered air defenses like Pantsir and S-300 systems. Those are designed for threats coming from further out or higher up. So they were practically inside the defensive perimeter before the drone even launched.
Pretty much, yeah. Inside the wire, effectively.
And the tech itself wasn't some secret military project either, was it? The sources keep mentioning off-the-shelf stuff.
Exactly. That's another striking part. They relied heavily on readily available tech, things like Autopilot open source software for flight control, Raspberry Pi computers, you know, those tiny cheap computers on board. And they used standard LTE mobile links for remote piloting, apparently often using Russia's own mobile networks against them.
Wow, using their own infrastructure.
It's leveraging global commercial tech, not waiting for slow, expensive military industrial development.
And AI. There was mention of AI playing a part. It wasn't just someone playing video game, right?
Yes, and Bondar flags this as crucial. The drones were reportedly enhanced with AI-trained object recognition models. Now, this wasn't likely full autonomy, you know, the drone deciding everything. It was more like AI assisting the human operator, helping them pinpoint the most vulnerable spots on those big planes, fuel tanks, wing pylons, maybe with really surgical accuracy.
So the AI guides the final moments.
Something like that. Bondar even notes the planning involves studying aircraft profiles, maybe even looking at planes in museums to train these AI models on exactly what to hit.
Practicing on museum pieces to hit the real thing. That mix. It's incredible. Simple, available tech, clever smuggling, and then this targeted AI application. It really does rewrite the playbook for precision strike.
It absolutely does. And the shockwaves from this, well, they go far beyond Ukraine.
For sure. In Washington, Strobel describes the reaction to Spider's Web as kind of a mix. Awe at the innovation, but also serious alarm about what it means for U.S. defenses.
Because this kind of attack hits right at American vulnerabilities. Strobel quotes Stacey Pettyjohn from CNAS, basically warning, the Pentagon should be very worried about this.
Mm.
And she points out, you know, U.S. strategic aircrafts often sit out in the open on runways, bases from Guam to Louisiana, just like those Russian planes did. Vulnerable.
And our defenses, according to the sources, still seem geared towards, well, older threats, right? Bigger, more expensive things. Strobel mentions that incident where drones apparently buzzed Langley Air Force Base and weren't challenged.
Yeah, and former NORTHCOM Commander General Glenn Van Hurick made a similar point. Even heavily protected, hardened aircraft are vulnerable when they're moving on the ground, taxiing, takeoff, landing, maintenance. This kind of cheap drone threat exploits those moments perfectly. The old defense model, built for manned planes or big missiles, it's clearly struggling with this new swarming low-cost threat.
It's not just a U.S. problem, though. David Kirichenko's piece in Small Wars Journal talks about how Ukraine's drone success is rapidly influencing NATO allies.
Oh, definitely. You see countries like Denmark, Finland, the UK, Germany. They're scrambling now. Building drone training centers, developing their own loitering munitions, you know, suicide drones. Germany's even talking about a drone wall on NATO's eastern flank, trying to deter potential Russian moves.
And it's not just air power. Kirichenko mentions huge numbers. Ukraine's commander-in-chief reporting over 83,000 Russian targets hit by drones in just 1 month, April 2025.
Like the naval side. Drones like Sea Baby and Magura V5s taking out Russian warships in the Black Sea. It's across domains.
So the allies are learning, adapting, but what about the big Western defense companies? How are they keeping up?
That's a huge challenge highlighted in the sources. There's a pretty blunt quote from Ukrainian MP Oleksandr Ustinova that Kirichenko includes. If your drone hasn't been tested in Ukraine, it's still just a toy.
Ouch. That really hits at the disconnect, doesn't it? This lightning-fast battlefield innovation versus the often glacial pace of traditional Western defense procurement.
Absolutely. And, you know, while the U.S. is dominant in those big, expensive, long-range UAVs like the Global Hawk, there aren't that many of them.
Yeah.
And they can be vulnerable in airspace with serious anti-air defenses. That U.S. design philosophy kind of grew up in uncontested airspace, which just isn't the reality anymore. Even the Houthis have shown they can take down sophisticated U.S. drones.
Right.
And that's a stark contrast to the mass-produced, cheap, almost disposable drones Ukraine and now increasingly Russia are using.
Which brings us right to this core tension, the speed of innovation versus the speed of procurement.
This might be the central systemic issue the sources point to. Both Bendit and Bondar talk about the incredible speed of the RDT&E cycle, research, development, testing, and evaluation in this conflict. It's shrunk from years, sometimes decades, down to just weeks or months for iterating drone designs.
And Ukraine has really embraced this, right? Building a whole domestic industry, over 200 companies. They're aiming for production in the millions of drones a year.
Yeah, and they've reformed their system too. Gondar mentions streamlining acquisitions, potentially down to like a week-long process, and creating a whole new branch of their military, the Unmanned Systems Force, just to manage this.
A week, compared to typical Western cycles.
Exactly. And Russia, interestingly, has also adapted. Bendit notes their development has shifted. It's not just the big state defense firms anymore. There's this rapidly growing volunteer and startup scene. They call it the People's VPK, the People's Military Industrial Complex. They focus on cheaper, expendable systems, often using commercial parts off AliExpress or wherever. And Russia is also aiming for mass production. Millions of drones annually is their goal, too.
Millions on both sides. It just changes the scale completely. It's not about these precious, super expensive platforms you can't afford to lose anymore.
It's about systems that are, well, cheap enough to be treated almost like ammunition. expendable. Yeah. And this mass production approach, whether it's state-led or more grassroots, it just highlights the problem with the traditional Western procurement process. That Haydian analysis basically calls it slow and risk-averse.
The Haydian analysis pulls no punches, does it?
Not really. They argue that defense acquisition has to change. It needs to embrace dual-use tech stuff with both civilian and military uses. It needs to work with startups. Things like open architecture, modular designs you can upgrade easily, integrating AI. These aren't nice-to-haves anymore. They argue they're battlefield imperatives if Western forces want to keep pace.
And if you have millions of these cheap drones flying around, you desperately need effective countermeasures. You can't keep shooting $600 drones with $2 million missiles. The math just doesn't work.
Exactly. Traditional air defenses just weren't built for this. Not this volume. Not these small, low-flying targets. Not coordinated swarms. They're often ineffective or way too expensive. So the sources stress this urgent need for layered defenses that are cost-effective. That means things like modern gun systems, advanced electronic jamming to break the control links, and developing cheaper interceptors specifically for drones. It's this constant, rapid back and forth, development, counter-development, especially in electronic warfare. Trying to jam the drones, then the drones get new frequencies, then you need new jammers.
Yeah.
It's relentless.
Let's circle back to AI and autonomy for a second. We talked about its role in Spider's Web. Based on the sources, what's the current state of play and where does it seem to be going?
Well, based on what we're seeing in reports from Bondar and others, current AI use seems mostly focused on enhancing what humans do. Flight stability, making the drones easier to fly. Target recognition, the AI might highlight things of interest. And that AI-assisted targeting we mentioned, where the AI helps aim, maybe tracks the target, but the human still pulls the trigger, basically, gives the final okay. The Spider's Web example fits this AI helping with that final maneuver based on pre-trained models. Its AI is a very capable assistant.
So more like a really smart co-pilot, not the plane flying itself entirely and deciding who to shoot, at least for now?
That seems to be the consensus from the sources, yeah. And it's worth remembering, terminology can be tricky here. Benda points out that sometimes when Russia talks about a swarm, it might not be AI coordinating them all autonomously. It could just be a group of drones, each flown by a separate human operator working together.
Oh, okay. That's an important distinction.
It is. And while Ukraine's been incredibly innovative with AI, Bondar's analysis does suggest there might be a kind of glass ceiling, meaning a lot of their current success uses open source AI tech. To make really big leaps forward into more complex autonomy or truly advanced AI might require significant investment in, you know, deep tech R&D, which isn't easy in the middle of a war.
Which loops right back to those procurement and industry challenges we discussed.
Absolutely. And, you know, while everyone's focused on capability, the ethical side is always there in the background. Dr. Rennick's work touches on this, the huge legal and ethical questions around more autonomy and weapons. There's this global debate about maintaining meaningful human control over lethal force, trying to avoid stumbling into some kind of dangerous autonomous arms race. The sources acknowledge that tension, advancing capability while managing the profound risks.
Okay, this has been a really comprehensive look. If we had to boil it down, what are the absolute key strategic takeaways from all this source material we've covered?
I think several big ones jump out. First, that asymmetric threat. It's real. It's proven. Cheap drones can take out billion-dollar assets, period. Second, agility is king. Technological speed, adapting faster than the adversary, that rapid RDT&E cycle. That's where strategic advantage lies now.
And it means nowhere is truly safe, right? Distance, traditional defenses, they don't guarantee security anymore. Spider's Web showed that. No sanctuary.
Exactly. Which leads to the next point. Military procurement has to change. It needs to get faster, embrace dual-use tech, work with startups, or risk just becoming irrelevant on the modern battlefield.
We're also seeing that humans working with AI is redefining precision attacks and maybe even survivability for the operators.
Definitely. And deception is back in a big way. That disguised logistics element in Spider's Web. Getting capabilities into position undetected is still critical.
And finally, maybe the most urgent point, the absolute need to develop and deploy effective, affordable, layered counter-drone systems. Systems that can handle the sheer scale and cost of this threat.
Yeah. At the end of the day, what this conflict really shows is this democratization of air power. Capabilities that used to belong only to major nations are now spreading much more widely.
It's a fascinating, maybe slightly terrifying picture. So here's the thought to leave you with. If yesterday's hobby kit can become today's strategic weapon, and our old defenses are struggling to keep up with the speed and the cost, What does that really mean for national security in the next few years? And maybe more importantly, who's actually ready to adapt?
That's the multi-billion-dollar question facing every military planner right now.
Indeed it is. Well, thank you for joining us for this deep dive. Remember, you can find more analysis and insights on these critical security topics over at thissecuritynexus.net. We hope you'll join us again next time.